We've been chatting with Robert, who's been very helpful. Let me just get started. Okay, so I think almost everyone here knows me, but for those of you who don't, I'm really more from like a quantum foundations background, but I've been working on this kind of quantum info application. The part of it that really excites me is this connection between particle physics and large superposition experiments. So those are things like matter interferometers, like two-slit experiments with big chunks of matter rather than just individual electrons or individual atoms or anything like that. And also nanomechanical resonators, which are these really huge devices, some of them big enough you can literally see with the naked eye, and you can get them to vibrate, and you can put them in quantum states, superpositions of vibrating and not vibrating, that kind of thing. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. Okay, so I used this bowling ball thing before. You've all seen it, but I really do like it, and it's helpful for people who haven't seen this idea before. So this is the outline. I'm going to first do this little bowling ball thought experiment. Then I'm going to talk about a new standard quantum limit for detecting diffusion and decoherence, which is going to make precise some of the things that it has. It's just kind of a way to understand kind of what's new and what's not new about this stuff. And then I'm going to talk about what exactly is ideal for these kind of searches. In particular, talking about tiny momentum transfers and soft but not weak interactions. Finally, we'll write down a kind of a candidate for dark matter that would scatter through kind of a medium range interaction of about 50 nanometers and put up some plots of the potential sensitivity. Okay, so this is the thought experiment. It's to suppose everything in the universe, including us, all the atoms in our body and all this stuff, are made out of big bowling balls. And we were kind of surrounded by a sea of very softly bouncing off of us slow-moving ping pong balls. And the question is this kind of, could we ever tell? The ping pong balls would know we were there, but we might not know that they were there because we're just kind of knocking them out of the way. So more abstractly, kind of, can you imagine new degrees of freedom that can see and feel us, but which we can't detect? And so there's a lot of kind of new physics that falls under this kind of a question. So to start off, I'm going to go back to something called this. It's usually called the standard quantum limit. That name applies to several related things, but this is one of the original for measuring weak forces. So the idea is to suppose we have to measure some weak force, like it's just a totally weak classical force. That's acting during a short time period, T, on some probe, something that you're going to watch and look for this force happening. So a probe of some mass M. The way this originally came up was in analysis of how are people going to detect back in the 80s when people started thinking about really getting serious about detecting gravitational waves. In that case, your time average force is zero. The gravitational wave wiggles, but then you come back to the same place you started, and so you have to make a measurement during that time period T, and you want to be able to see these very, very tiny shifts. And if you're kind of restricted to position or position-like measurements, what you find is you know, the idea is that you make your initial position measurement, you're going to wait some time, and then you're going to make a final position measurement. So you kind of prepare your system in some localized wave packet. You want to get a pretty good idea where it is. You let the force act on it. And it is just going to displace it over this totally classical distance, just given by the normal acceleration. But for sufficiently weak forces, the wave packet is just not displaced enough to be detectable. You might think that if you just, well, I'll just narrow the wave packet down so then I can see smaller adjustments. At some point, it actually doesn't help anymore. These tiny, small initial widths mean that the wave packet have very uncertain momentum, and the thing kind of shoots out as soon as you let go of it. So there's actually some optimal width, and there's like a smallest measurable displacement if you're starting with these kind of measurements and in this kind of a state, like a localized wave packet. So this kind of minimum force measurement is known as the standard quantum limit. The smallest measurable displacement implies a weakest possible force. None of this is is all that important, but if you've seen this before, the important thing is just that this, you know, this, you can figure this out essentially by dimensional analysis. And it's just, you know, depends on the probe mass m and the time interval t. But it's always based off of, I have a certain probe. I have something I'm going to watch, and I'm assuming that because of experimental realities, I'm restricted to certain kinds of preparations and measurements. But you can beat the force SQL by violating that assumption. And the alternative is to produce superpositions of widely separated wave packets, like in an interferometer. So in an interferometer, if you can imagine kind of two wave packets traveling around the two arms here, whatever that weak force is that's acting over the interferometer, it's associated with some potential difference. And that potential energy difference produces a measurable phase shift in the interferometer. And as you extend the distance between the arms, you get a higher and higher sensitivity that isn't limited you are if you're restricted to not having superpositions. And so you can, in principle, measure arbitrarily weak forces for sufficiently wide wave packet separation. So then you're kind of you're limited. The thing you're limited by is how much kind of coherence you can get over what kind of spatial distances. And this is the origin of the extreme sensitivity to very weak forces in kind of atom interferometry experiments. Several of these are in the kind of planning stages. Maybe there's one that, I can't remember, one of them was going to go up to the International Space Station at one point. But there's some other exciting proposals, this atomic gravitational wave what's that? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a really, I mean, this is one where you get a superposition over like 40 meters or something absurd. And really gives you a very high sensitivity. Advanced LIGO for detecting gravitational waves basically has to, you know, they're at the point now where they're bumping up against the standard quantum limit. They're not going to do something so crazy just yet as putting the mirrors in superpositions of just totally distinct states, but they are using really quantum states to get around the limit. So they're using squeeze states for the input into the interferometers. Okay, so this is all well-known stuff. The thing is the gravitational waves, or any of the waves, or any of the forces we were talking about, are weak classical forces, and a classical influence on a, you know, even if it's a very quantum probe, you can always just model that as some unitary interaction on it. But if you're looking for small particles bouncing off you, like these ping pong balls, some Brownian bath or another source of diffusion, it can't be modeled as unitary. In particular, the particles can become entangled with you if you're sitting there as the bowling ball, or your probe is the bowling ball. So what we can do is we can prove an analogous limit, a standard quantum limit, for detecting collisional decoherence, so superpositions of bowling balls, just like you can for weak forces. And so that's what's in the PRA. And so the kind of prototypical source, which is the scenario that this is proved for, is collisional decoherence in quantum Brownian motion. So what's quantum Brownian motion kind of in the really abstract sense? It's basically, this is the equations of motion for a single degree of freedom. So if you kind of get rid of d here, this will just be some nice, simplest kind of possible quadratic Hamiltonian you can imagine. But then you introduce this term d, and this gives you the influence of very small momentum kicks. And there's a sense in which if you have a weak source of diffusion that's Markovian, this is kind of the most general possible form that kind of decoherence can take. So f parameterizes the strength of the force, and again, d parameterizes the strength of this diffusion and decoherence. It turns out that in this case, momentum diffusion, your kind of ability, your jiggling that happens in momentum space, is exactly the same thing in the weak limit as the decoherence in spatial position, meaning how well you're getting measured in space by things like new particles that are kind of coming in, scattering off you, and they're taking position information, which way information away. And so you can get a little bit of a sense of how that works, that if you just kind of imagine, so again, this is just a single degree of freedom, so this is the density matrix for a single degree of freedom, just the position of a probe you can imagine. And then if you think about the really far off diagonal terms, such that this term dominates, it causes the density matrix to evolve a lot faster than the Hamiltonian, what you just get is this exponential suppression here of the off diagonal terms. And so that's the source of the spatial decoherence. So along with F, this coefficient D is one of like a really small number of parameters which parameterize a class of Markovian dynamics. And I've just kind of become enamored with this recently, so I encourage you all. There's a few papers written about it, but I think it's really neat and underappreciated. For if you want to know more about how open quantum systems work, if you want to have like a really good toy model in your head for how to think about open quantum systems that's totally tractable, linear, completely solvable, quantum Brownian motion in this framework, and in particular the kind of symplectically covariant version of it. So it's exactly the same thing as Lorentz covariance. So in the sense that, right, so symplectic transformations, and we're just talking about one degree of freedom here. So symplectic transformations are like rotations in phase space, and they're the stretching and skewing motions. And so a symplectic covariant quantum Brownian motion means you can write it down in kind of symplectically covariant notation. So you have little indices that they range over just x and p rather than x, y, z, and t. It's very nice. Everything's completely solvable. And there's like a bunch of different cases. People call different things quantum Brownian motion. And the reason is they're all different special cases of this symplectically covariant formalism. So something I really highly recommend if you're just like, oh man, I want to know a little bit more about decoherence without having to work hard. So just a real quick a comparison, right? So the force SQL gives you some maximum sensitivity or minimum force measurement you can make with over time t with a mass m, and you just can't detect forces smaller than that unless you have non-classical states measurements. And you can do the exact same thing for diffusion. You have some diffusion coefficient d, right? This is telling you how much you're wiggling in momentum space from tiny little kicks that you're getting from something new. And you can't detect diffusion that is smaller than that SQL. I'm not going to prove it here, but I'm just going to kind of draw a picture because it's really very intuitive. And again, you can get this all by estimate by dimensional analysis. So on the left side is a force SQL. And so the idea is that you start in that dotted state, right? So this is your the norm squared of the wave function. So that's what you look like in space. And then this is the Wigner's function in phase space. And the Wigner function is just a one-to-one mapping. And you can do all your dynamics in phase space just as well as you do in position space. And so the idea is you start in that dotted thing, and then you're trying to distinguish between two scenarios. In this case, it would be like the blue scenario and the red scenario, one where you got pushed hard and one where you didn't get pushed very much or got pushed not at all. And the idea is that if you can only kind of make position or nearly position measurements, because of the width of this distribution, you just can't distinguish between not moving and moving very slightly. But if you get a far enough push, you can. You can do the exact same thing in phase space. Yeah, I didn't quite say that right. So the dotted is the initial state. That was my. So the dotted initial state, black is no force. Blue is a small force after a certain amount of time. Sorry, yeah. Yeah. So you get the system evolved. Exactly. Right. Sorry, thank you. And so you see the same thing if you have diffusion, right? So diffusion is scooching you around phase space. If it's spreading you out in momentum, that's kind of the initial thing that happens, but because you get spread momentum, you also end up getting spread in position too. So you kind of grow in all directions here. And if you want to distinguish between the kind of diffusive motion and the non-diffusive motion, you just need to be larger than that amount. Okay, so just like the traditional kind of force SQL for forces, the diffusion SQL can be beaten by non-classical preparations, like cascades, and kind of you can beat it just a little bit if you use things like squeeze states. And there's actually a totally simple and pretty symmetry kind of between these two things is that you can imagine that if, again, you're using this interferometer, you're trying to make a really sensitive device, if you have a force, just like I talked about before, it works out to be some phase in the, you know, relative phase between the interferometer arms. The source of diffusion, literally the kind of the first order effect is just this guy. So it's just a real or imaginary part of the off-diagonal terms of the density matrix for an object passing through an interferometer. So this kind of weak forces and weak diffusion are you know, very symmetric here. And just to kind of hammer it home one more time, or another way to say it, is that there is a precise way. Anytime somebody says something like classically undetectable, there's a bunch of different ways to interpret that. But there is a H bar goes to zero limit where, you know, you kind of keep the macroscopic dimensions of your experiment fixed, and you imagine H bar going to zero, say before we knew how big H bar was. And so you don't really know where the scale of quantum mechanics is. And in that limit, you know, your wave packets become points of phase space. And the point is that you can take DNF, which are macroscopic things, they're macroscopic forces or diffusion, you can take those to zero, but the phase shift and the decoherence in this device remain finite. So, you know, if you kind of were in a classical laboratory and you just had a magical machine that could produce superpositions, produce wave packets like this, you know, insofar as you didn't even know how small H bar was, you could kind of get infinite sensitivity from using a device like this.
So this, you take the latent separation goes to infinity.
You take the what?
The separation between wave packets to infinity.
No, that's what's cool about this. So it's basically the other limit. You keep, it's just a different way of thinking about it. It is the same thing.
Yeah.
You keep the macroscopic. Exactly. 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 Yeah. And that's kind of that's the resource, right? Yeah. Okay. So large, and in this case we're gonna be talking kind of mesoscopic. So larger than just individual atoms and this kind of stuff. These are really uniquely sensitive detectors. And so another kind of picture to think about is that, you know, if you're trying to look for kicks, you have some probe. So I say something? That's just my. You have some probe, a mass, and it's getting kicked by something. You're trying to, you know, determine if you're getting these little jumps. Then if you kind of put its, you know, classically it would be a phase-based distribution. Quantum mechanically, it's a Wigner function. It looks the same. That when you're in a very hot state, right? You're holding something in a trap, so it's very hot and it's got some spread over phase space. Your sensitivity isn't as good. But then as you kind of cool it down, you get smaller and smaller until you kind of reach H bar. And this is the zero temperature state at which kind of maximizes your sensitivity given that this is your only thing to slide up and down. Your only lever is the temperature. And okay. And then once you hit the ground state, so once you get down to H bar equals zero, so your zero temperature, if you want further sensitivity, you need non-classical state. So this has the SQL sensitivity. And then you can do all sorts of stuff. So the simplest example is just cat state. So this is the Wigner function of a normal superposition. So just two wave packets that are separated. And as you pull them apart, the Wigner function develops this very, very fine phase structure, and it becomes sensitive then to very, very tiny shifts. And so this sometimes gets stamped with quantum enhanced sensitivity. And there's a sense in which you're kind of going below negative temperature. But it doesn't have to be just really simple kind of cat states. You know, you can have these, you know, four superpositions of four different locations in phase space. Again, you can just do squeezing if you squeeze it large enough. But the important thing is you have to kind of go beyond simple wave packets localized in phase space. And the key feature, the thing that makes it possible, is the spatial coherence, kind of how far off diagonal do you have terms in the density matrix. And these end up in the Wigner function. The Wigner function is just a Fourier transform of the density matrix in the kind of a rotated basis. And those are what gives it that fine structure. And this is the last slide, I believe, on all this stuff. This is all very nice, you know, your sensitivity here is going to be proportional to L squared, that distance between the two. And just as L goes to zero, you recover the standard quantum limit. So it's this whole kind of continuum of states that are very intuitive. Okay, and so at the end, the punchline is, well, I don't know if these ping pong balls, if they, you know, really tiny momentum transfers, are they there? So what I do instead of watching a bowling ball and looking for its shift is I produce a superposition of bowling balls. I look at the interference pattern, and then I remove the little door. I see the interference pattern goes away because the bowling balls have been decohered. The ping pong balls take away which path information, and I say, aha, there were ping pong balls in that little cabinet that I was keeping them in. I think this is cool. And so the idea is, what can you actually do with this? In particular, now moving towards particle physics, what sorts of particles and forces would fit the bill for something that you could detect using this that you couldn't detect any other way? And you really got to look for something that you couldn't detect any other way, because in general, creating superpositions of large amounts of matter is really, really hard. So if you could do it any other way, you should do it that way. But what would be good? So in this case, what you want is a high flux of particles scattering elastically and often, but transferring tiny amounts of momentum. And so this is what I mean by a soft interaction, but not a weak one in the sense of a weak coupling constant, because you want it actually happening very often. This is very different than things like the weak force when you have a neutrino come in. The neutrinos interact very, very rarely with normal matter most of the time. But when they do interact, it's this explosive thing, right? On the atomic scale, it's very dramatic. And so we're actually kind of looking for the opposite case. That's what this is good for. And then just kind of the considerations, what is the best kind of superposition that you could produce? What's the best probe you can consider? Well, the momentum sensitivity, the size of those momentum kicks you're going to be able to be sensitive to, is determined by the superposition separation. That tells you how much momentum the object has to the hypothetical bath has to deliver in order to decohere that superposition. So that sets the scale of your sensitivity. Again, larger is better. Heavier targets reduce recoil, so that's bad if you're doing a classical experiment, but they actually increase the scattering cross-section for these quantum experiments. It doesn't matter what your recoil is. The whole idea is that this is going to be interesting when the recoil is smaller than the width of the wave packet. And then finally, there's this last thing that's really important for these type of experiments, which is this effect called coherent elastic scattering. So I got one slide on that very quickly. So coherent elastic scattering, it's this very general property of soft elastic scattering from targets composed of a bunch of charges. So if you have something that is bound together and has n charges, and this is not going to depend on kind of the details of the particles or the mediator, just you have many charges all bound together and they recoil uniformly. When the wavelength of the incident particle, whatever is kind of seeing that charge and scattering from it, is larger than the size of the object, so the de Broglie wavelength kind of covers the whole thing. And in particular, it's the momentum transfer, but for right now, you can really just think about the de Broglie wavelength of the incident object. What you find is that all the different paths contribute coherently. The reason is that basically the particle doesn't know what it's scattered off of. And so when you kind of calculate your out states, they all just add together before they get squared rather than after, because they're indistinguishable. And usually that's not even really a concern, because this is useful when the momentum transfer is so small, so it is really not at risk. But yeah, that's right. When you're in an intermediate kind of region, when you have a object that's got a bunch of charges and you have something scatter off of it, you have something. Scatter off it that's got kind of an intermediate size. So the momentum transfer, the wavelength of the thing that's scattering is, you know, the small compared to the charges in here, or rather large compared to it, but still small compared to the object size. You get kind of an intermediate effect. So when it's very tiny, you get no enhancement, and the cross section goes like n. When it's very large, you get an enhancement of n. So the cross-section goes like n squared. And for intermediate size things, you can get complicated interference effects. But for the most part, especially for large objects, they tend to wash out. And you get a very smooth turn on of the coherence enhancement. And because we're going to be looking at large objects superposed, scattering things very softly, this effect is really important and occurs in basically almost all of the cases that we care about. Okay, so what kind of superposition targets do we want? Well, we can superpose photons over many kilometers. They always tend to do this in like really nice places so that you can go to these islands and hang out in the sun. But you know, they have no inertia, and they're not very good targets. We can do neutrons over macroscopic distances, but again, they don't have very much mass, so if they get kicked, they would tend to move okay if you could really measure them that closely and it happened that often. So we're really interested in what are the heaviest objects we can superpose over a length scale that also contains them. And that's going to guarantee this coherent scattering enhancement, right? I guess I'm not actually, I'm trying to remember why you wrote that. What's that? It should be mass.
It should, you mean the number of degrees of freedom that you can scatter
over? Yeah, the charge.
And right?
That's right. I mean, so the inertia is important in a sense. This is going to be hand wavy rather than super precise. The idea is that if you have a very light object that has all these charges and you can still watch it carefully, well, if it's lighter, it'll get kicked better, right? But they're not entangled. So the key idea is that the objects, they're either all on the left or they're all on the right, and this is going to give you dramatically more sensitivity than if you sent them through. You know, if you just had an atom interferometer. Photons, yeah.
Yeah. So these are the down conversions where you have.
Yeah. So then you have two. So you have a factor of two. But there are no right. So you know, one thing they've always wanted to create are noon states, right? Where you either got n photons in one side of the interferometer and in the other, and there they're reaching like n equals 6 is a really big deal.
I see. So you need these are not really noon states; it's just every single photon going one way or the other.
Exactly, and that boils down to because right, photons are right. The electromagnetic field is linear, right? In a way that atoms are not; they clump, and that's what allows them to kind of all be in one place or the other place at the same time. Okay, so the thing that this is really perfect for is matter interferometers. So these are basically two slit experiments. I mean, there's some slight differences, but they're basically two slit experiments, only instead of individual atoms, they're sending through big chunks of matter on these kind of scales. So the kind of world records right now are at 10 to the 4 AMU, you know, 10 to the 4 like protons and neutrons kind of size, hundreds of atoms. Those tend to kind of come in at the nanometer range, so kind of nanoparticles, and they're going to be pushing beyond that in the near future. Okay, so that's the devices we're most going to concentrate on, and then so the question is what are we going to try to detect? So this is just kind of the boilerplate motivation from dark matter. It's only I think two or three slides. But the idea here, right, is that dark matter is this big outstanding question. We think that there's some new non-baryatic form of gravitating matter, and we have evidence from all sorts of scales that it's out there. All the evidence we have, the kind of knockdown evidence, is essentially gravitational. And this is just a really hard topic that a lot of people have been thinking about for a very long time. And anything you kind of going to suggest has to satisfy this very wide range of experiments and observations. This stretches back to a very long time. But yet you still have kind of few model independent results. But there is a generic thing we know about dark matter, insofar as we think we know much about it at all, this we feel pretty confident about, is that there's a roughly spherical, there's a little bit of arguments, but still some sort of virialized halo of dark matter enveloping the Milky Way with these rough parameters, which we take, importantly, from present-day observations. It doesn't require a lot of cosmology, and there's not too much disagreement, although there's a few people in the building who are very vocal about it otherwise. And these are always assumed. Anytime you see limits from WIMP searches, underground WIMP searches, these are assumed because people are pretty confident. So this is the kind of picture we're going to be taking for granted. And so the idea is to look for dark matter of this sort, scattering by small momentum transfers on the order of 50 nanometers or less, because this is kind of the scales of these superpositions that we can produce. But otherwise, we want it to be very rarely interacting, right? Because we want it to not have seen it yet. So Itai suggested we're going to look for basically something that's forward scattering off of atoms, off of nuclei, through some new massive scalar mediator. So one thing this can be is something like a heavy photon. You can gauge B minus L. I'm not going to talk too much about it. The only thing we're going to need to know, essentially, is the mediator wavelength, and to set it in the very rough neighborhood within a few orders of magnitude of this momentum transfer that we're going to be sensitive to. And so that means the mediator mass, this boson is going to be somewhere between a tenth of an EV and a keV in that general region. And what's nice about this kind of a situation is that non-relativistically, like this is kind of all this force is good for. If you don't add in a bunch of more moving parts, it transfers this amount of momentum and it doesn't like to do very much else. If you want this sort of an interaction between, so that this is the nucleus on the bottom here, right, the big N, and then some dark particle on the top, you immediately then have to consider that you're going to get interactions between nuclei. And that this is basically going to look like a Yukawa potential. And we've been looking for these kind of deviations from inverse squared law that would be evidence of forces between kind of all nucleons, perhaps with varying dependency on isotopic composition. And so actually the constraints on this model of dark matter are going to come most strongly from existing searches for Yukawa forces rather than anything about dark matter in particular. So these Casimir forces and the neutron scattering experiments are going to be our strongest constraints. And so this is really about nucleon-nucleon interactions rather than dark matter-nucleon interactions. This is where the existing constraints come from. Let me see, did I put it up? Maybe I didn't. I've been up there. So you're going to have, this is the nucleus. You're going to have some coupling to normal matter, and you're going to have some coupling to dark matter. And there's really not going to be a value of this coupling between the new boson and dark matter that both avoids dark matter self-interaction constraints and is still detectable, right? So we have these constraints from the bullet cluster where we have galaxies, or I guess galaxy clusters, colliding. And if you had the dark matter interaction cross-section for the whole bulk of the dark matter, you would just see that show up in the bullet cluster. You'd see the dark matter peel off. So there's no value that kind of satisfies that constraint, but is still detectable in general for the kind of experiments we're going to be thinking of. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this order one, and then we're going to evade the bullet cluster constraint by just assuming it's a subcomponent of the dark matter. So we can imagine a situation, which I think is very natural, where dark matter, the dark sector is very complicated. It's just like normal matter. Maybe it has bound states. Maybe it has whatever. And so it's just part of a big, vast dark sea. And we can add bells and whistles to this to kind of suppress the interactions that we're going to be talking about or enhance them. So what I'm going to kind of show up here are just kind of rough guides. If you're at like a 10%. Distribution of dark matter with alpha dm taken to be roughly one, and then you can imagine all sorts of ways to tweak this to see more or see less.
So I think Itai's been thinking about that a bit more.
Okay, I think that's kind of still in progress at this point. Hence, no paper yet. OK, so but for the purposes of thinking about decoherence, the only thing we need to know is the cross section, right? The kind of microscopic explanation for that cross section you can kind of talk about separately. So if we're, yeah, absolutely. So
So my impression is that that was mostly kind of harder interactions than we're
Because the momentum exchange is bigger, so then it's the cross section is suppressed. What else?
I mean, the rate of dangerous things is much lower. I can't remember exactly what the effects all are, but the most dangerous.
And you're talking about cosmic rays, not galactic kind of. There's these limits that come right from if dark matter is kind of passing through the disk and yeah.
Yeah, so this would be like the cosmic rays that we observe would actually slow down, for example, like the spectrum of cosmic rays would be quantified if they have to travel through a medium where
right.
they strongly interact with.
Right.
Right. So the spectrum would be very different.
Right.
I remember vaguely about this one of these papers that looks at quantum strong interactive dark matter by passes through the atmosphere, by passes through some all types of
not something recent.
Where is it at?
Okay.
How would they know that with the velocity distribution of different kind of
impact? So what do you mean with the velocity distribution?
You said that the effect was that they slow down as they come through
the cosmic rays.
The cosmic rays slow down. I have to take a look. So we're going to be looking at these three parameters. So we're looking at the coupling to normal matter. We're going to look at the mass of the mediator, which sets the range of this new force. And then we're going to look at the mass of whatever dark matter particle is interacting. Again, some subcomponent. So like I said, all of the exclusions, kind of existing exclusions, are going to be on the range here. So this is the length scale on the bottom, or equivalently the mediator mass scale on the top. I'm sorry, that's a little smaller than I was hoping for. So let me, so this is, right, so this is like micron scale, 10 to the minus 6, nanometer scale, angstrom scale. So up in the middle, roughly, is a 10 eV mediator. And then we've got a few orders of magnitude at the side. And then alpha's ranging up and down on the left, and there's quite a number of orders of magnitude here. And so these are the constraints, again, just from looking at from normal matter, experiments involving normal matter, mostly coming from neutron experiments, just because neutrons are neutral, so you can eliminate most of the electromagnetic force concerns on these kind of scales, and also from Casimir force experiments. So the gray region there is excluded. And so the question is we're kind of, okay, so that's our parameter space that we're thinking about. And we want to know what would, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What is the reaction from the right? This is relative to gravity.
That's right. That's right. So it's different normalization. Yeah. So this is right, yeah, this is very, only 7 orders of magnitude off of gravity. So pretty weak down there. So what does it look like? Right, so it's going to scatter coherently over again, if we're talking about 50 nanometers, over these big size volumes that is going to contain the whole object that you're superposing. And so that can really fit in more than 10 to the 7 atoms, which is pretty darn big. And when you get this coherence enhancement, right, you're going from rather one atom at n equals 1 to n squared for 10 to the 7 is quite a big boost. which is really where a lot of the sensitivity comes from. And it's going to, so you're going to get this very tiny amount of momentum going into a very relatively heavy object that's just barely going to be budged. And so you're looking, if you were just to think about it classically, kind of if I was looking at that target, what's going to happen, it's going to have a, you know, 10 to the minus 17 EV energy deposition, just something that you can't possibly see. And even with these big objects, it would have these big enhancements. It's going to be a relatively rare event. And so kind of looking for them at microscopic scales rather than in the bulk is very difficult. Now, if you were to consider this dark matter just scattering off of kind of free particles, they happen, but in much, much smaller rate because of this enhancement. So if you were going to ask kind of this rough type of dark matter, you know, how often is it going to be scattering off of just atoms that are sitting around? It's barely, you know, extremely, extremely rarely. And it collides more frequently with larger objects, but then again, you have this incredibly small amount of momentum and energy deposited, and so this seems, you know, you check a bunch of the most sensitive devices you can imagine. You check some of the things, you know, we looked at were transition edge sensors that have these very super sensitive bolometers that measure tiny depositions, and none of these seem to be sensitive to this kind of a scenario. Yeah, so the classical effect, and we'll show that to you on the plot. The classical effect is the phase, and that corresponds to the force applied by the dark matter. So if you were in the dark matter rest frame, meaning the dark matter was isotropic, that force goes to zero. But because we're moving through the galaxy, it's going to push on it and give it a net force. So there will be a few parts of these plots by, you know, a pretty small minority, where you will see the phase, but there won't be any decoherence. Of course, if there is decoherence, then the phase gets wiped out anyways.
Yeah, but there is a velocity, right? 10^-3. We do move to the dark matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, you know, it will definitely show up in a few types of...
Is it proportional to the cross-section again, the phase? Yes.
So the...
So you say, if you talk about the phase...
Yep. Yeah, okay. Okay, so what are you actually going to see? Again, these are the Wigner functions of these superpositions. So you have a superposition of kind of being on the left and on the right. You're going to get a suppression of these little wiggles in the Wigner function, but you're not going to get an actual shift of the two main wave packets. And so kind of what does it look like in your interferometer? Well, you set up your interferometer. You create the superposition of kind of being on the left, on the right. That's your initial state. If there's no decoherence and you've got everything tuned right, you know, it effectively has trivial evolution. And then what the beam splitter at the end does is it makes a measurement in kind of the plus minus basis, right? And you always end up, if you tune your thing right, you always end up in one port and not the other port. On the other hand, if you're starting out in this same initial state, but you assume there's some sort of dark matter in state, you have a final state where the dark matter scatters off. You know, essentially zero momentum transfer. You know, what that means here is of just that these states are essentially unshifted, but full decoherence would be the situation where the two out states are fully distinguishable. And in that case, then you would see the dark matter come in because you would basically have your other port would go off. The one that shouldn't be there gets lit up. So this is anomalous decoherence in an experiment. But of course the good experimental question is, well, there's lots of possible sources of decoherence in experiments. It's like the whole name of the game is dealing with all these sources of decoherence. How could you, you know, kind of when you're building these experiments, you kind of beat one level of decoherence after the other, right? When you eliminate black body radiation by cooling it down enough, then suddenly the vibrations in your device are the next thing. And you have to kind of beat one after the other. So just seeing anomalous decoherence that you can't explain doesn't imply dark matter, for sure. But the first thing to note is that the reverse statement or the inverse statement is true. That this shouldn't have been a resonator. That should just be superposition. If you run your interferometer and you see an interference pattern, then you have eliminated the dark matter, right? Because the dark matter comes in multiplicatively into the decoherence factor. And so you can exclude dark matter robustly just by getting your experiment to operate, basically. But so suppose you got anomalous decoherence, and you think it's dark matter. How would you be sure of that? So the first thing you do is you might try varying some of the experimental parameters. So I just missed that resonator should be an interferometer. You kind of change all the how long it is, what the objects are, how big they are, how hot they can be. Some of these interferometers they create hot objects, and you vary all of these parameters. And the decoherence will vary too, and it will vary in a precise way on those different things, and that will in general be different than external sources of decoherence. One of the kind of more striking ones is you can imagine doing the experiment, making a superposition with something that was different isotopes, so that kind of from the outside, everything looks exactly the same, right? Because it's electrically identical. But the dark matter, which is actually probing in and seeing the nucleus, will be able to tell there's a different isotopic composition. So those are the kind of things that you can imagine varying and seeing if the amount of decoherence kind of varies in the expected way. but more directly, you can try influencing the expected flux. So there's a lot to say here, and I won't go into it, but the most dramatic thing you can imagine is where if you just had a really big chunk of lead or concrete, and you kind of put it over your device, and it blocks all the dark matter or whatever else is coming in, and you see interference. If you move the device, or rather you remove the shield, the decoherence comes in, the interference pattern goes away, and that's pretty strong evidence. There's other effects that come in terms of changing the dark matter flux in ways you don't kind of control quite as well. So some of these are kind of DAMA-like situations where you're looking for 24-hour periods or even year-long periods. And then the last really dramatic effect is that for certain dark matter parameters, when the wavelength is basically long or longer than the superposition, the orientation of the interferometer is going to affect the degree of decoherence. So you can just spin your interferometer around. You'll see a different amount of interference fringe visibility depending on its orientation. And you'll actually be able to kind of point the interferometer and figure out which direction in the galaxy you're going, if it's really coming from a dark matter wind. And so these devices are directional detectors. OK, so finally, getting closer to the end here, we're just going to put up the plots for these existing and proposed interferometers. And these give you a sense of what's feasible both now and in the medium-term future. For big superpositions. And these are kind of experiments that have really been progressing very quickly. So I'm going to, in particular, look at four. I'm going to describe these all. They're each going to have their own slide very quickly, just to give you a sense of what they are. The purpose of this slide is just to let you know that, so this first one is a experiment that exists now that is running at its design version. It's in the basement at the University of Vienna. The second one, also in the same basement, because those guys are the best, is the OTMA experiment. It also exists, but it's currently scaling up. It's two or three orders of magnitude off of the mass that they expect to achieve in the next couple years. This third one is a proposal, but it's one that my understanding is that it's considered very reasonable and achievable. I'll describe it in a second. Yeah, I didn't have a good name for that one, so I just named it after the authors. They didn't name it themselves, right? So, and then this last one is something that would be, you know, really aggressive, which is a satellite proposal for creating a really enormous superposition in space. And so that one's like very speculative, right? These basically satellites don't happen to a first approximation; they don't exist. but it does give you a sense of kind of what's possible if you really care, if you really wanted to push it. So this is the existing experiment. This is the kind of world record holder for large superpositions. So they've achieved 10 to the 4 AMU objects. And this was back in 2011. This is the experiment that's currently scaling up. Let me go back to here. This guy actually used physical gratings like literally, you know, little slots in a mask. This is the next generation experiment. It's actually going to use laser gratings, the kind of standing laser fields, and they ionize the object as they go by. They expect to get up to much higher masses with this, a million AMU. So really very large objects of like 5 nanometer size. This is a fairly recent proposal that was just notable because it pushed so many good parameters for this kind of an experiment. So there's a lot of proposals for creating big superpositions. But this one was both feasible and had a lot of good qualities for detecting things like dark matter. And this is kind of a hybrid. So there's a lot of these optical trap experiments where they try to trap a particle and then cool it down near its ground state or even to its ground state. And in this case, they were literally just going to do that and then drop it over the a standing laser that would act as a slit grating and then kind of build up the interference pattern below it. And then finally, this is the really pie-in-the-sky satellite proposal. This one is an optical trap, and this is a cool experiment. Here they would literally, this is just an optical table that sits in the vacuum of space behind a sun shield. So it's just, I think that it expects to just cool down passively down to 7 Kelvin or so. And you just create the superposition out in the vacuum of space facing away from the sun. Quantum mechanics, man. Yeah, exactly. So when they're forced to like write justifications, they say they're testing like modifications of quantum mechanics, like objective collapse of the wave function. Exactly. There's other reasons to do this. I mentioned a couple of them at the end. You can do really sensitive classical force experiments with these guys. In fact, kind of a you remember that the constraints on Yukawa type potentials a little bit farther down in the corner of this graph. The next generational experiments will be able to kind of eat out from there, not assuming anything about dark matter, just making those measurements like that. And so these guys can do similar things. That's right. That's right. By more than its size. So I think it's on the order of 200 nanometer separation. That's right. Yeah, and I think this one, they estimate, and they're serious, I guess, that they can get coherence for like a minute or something like this. Yeah, exactly. So, like, comparable to the Aegis satellite, only with this enormous object.
No, but this is a huge thing. It will radiate like crazy.
So it cools down to the optical table cools down to 7K.
No, but there is internal temperature of the silica particles, right? So they emit blood body radiation, but they have to.
But that one radiation is quite low wave.
That's right. Well, it's been a while since I. So these are the Vienna guys. Yeah. So they've checked it. Yeah, exactly. So the guy who I think is a young assistant faculty guy who's behind this is. No. So Aspermeyer's and Marcus Arndt, I think, are on most of these papers. They're on the proposal. Their names are on the proposals. But the guy who is really leading it is Cal Ten Back, I think is how you. I think that's how you spell his name. A very nice guy.
Can I think of that as generally the limiting thing? All these proposals are they limited in size by the wavelength of the half wavelength of the light that they're using to split?
So it depends on what kind of techniques you want to use. So for like this, for these the Aegis experiment, they get these huge distances, and they do it by kind of kicking it with a laser, right? And whether it absorbs it or doesn't absorb a photon can cause it to spread out.
Right. So that's what that those use single atoms.
That's right.
This is just a big piece of just just a little ball of silicon.
So this is like, I saw a present. What's that?
This is
10 to the 10 AMU. Oh, atoms 10 to the 9. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
So the idea is if you want to make use of that coherence effect we're talking about at the beginning, the n squared.
Yep.
Then you need the light to be bigger than the.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Right. And then so we're kind of taking. I mean, none of this is conservative. The whole talk's not conservative. But the few conservative assumptions I'm going to make is that dark matter, it enters the Earth and it is absorbed and disappears, because that would give you the smallest signal. You can imagine all sorts of situations where it gets kind of reflected, so it comes back at you with the same energy and it bounces around in the atmosphere. And in fact, the atmosphere will play a role. I'll talk about it briefly. You can imagine it, getting absorbed in the Earth and rattling around and thermalizing, and then getting kicked back out. All sorts of crazy stuff could go on. I'm going to ignore those scenarios right now, and then I'll show you, if you were really optimistic, kind of what would show up if you kind of tweak these scenarios to be best for you. Okay, so this is the parameter space. Again, our three parameters are the range, the strength of the interaction, and then it's going to be the dark matter mass. And so the gray here, this is all excluded. I'm going to go over this plot slowly, but feel free to ask questions. This black line is the exclusion line. The gray is not coming in very good, but everything above this black line right here is excluded. And then the experiments are. Well, I guess they're not quite in the same order as I presented them. So KDTL, this is the existing experiment. This is the proposal to kind of point source this optically trapped particle that you dropped over a laser. This is the Otumin experiment, which is should exist basically within the next couple years at its full design abilities.
What's the
design number? 10 to the 6. Yep. Maybe even more than that. Like. He won't put in print more than 10 to the 6, but he thinks he can push that a little bit. And then this is the satellite. So the shaded in regions are the kind of parameter regions that you would be sensitive to. So you're looking at several orders of magnitude of possible range. And then in here you've got a few orders of magnitude if you're talking about the Otumin experiment. And the satellite is amazing. And this is really, if you look at how these Yukawa force experiments are done, right? They just eke out really tiny little new slivers every time they push the technology. So something like the macro satellite would just be totally crazy. Obviously, not. This would only apply to the dark matter scenario. Whereas this is excluded more generally. But it does give you a sense of just how much these kind of what these experiments could do. So the one thing to note about this are these three dashed gray lines. And right, so every point on this diagram, we're keeping the dark. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this. This is for an MeV dark matter mass. I'll flash some plots for different masses. So every point on this diagram with a 1 MeV dark matter particle, right, corresponds to some scenario where you've got some range for the force and some strength of the coupling. Everything above this line means the dark matter is going to scatter at least once in the atmosphere. However, because this is this very soft interaction, it's going to hit some nitrogen molecule at a very 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 glancing blow for when the range is long here, and so the kind of more important limit is going to be the one where it actually isotropizes. So it's going to take enough of these little kicks that it's going to be redeflected from its initial trajectory. Furthermore, even once it isotropizes, it's still coming in with the same energy. The ability for the dark matter at kind of an MeV mass compared to a nitrogen molecule, right, which is 28 AMU, something like that, 28 GeV, the ability to transfer energy is suppressed by that mass ratio, and so you actually have to have many more interactions, and therefore a stronger coupling strength before the dark matter will thermalize in the atmosphere. And I don't want to—I won't go into it, but there's a bunch of like, you know, kind of crazy things that can happen where you get greenhouse effects and whatnot. And I'll show you the really optimistic scenarios. But this is kind of what you expect to see, because this Bateman-Hall experiment it does not get into the unexcluded region before the isotropization line. It does not see anything, but the OTIMA experiment and the macro experiment would. And so this you don't really have to pay attention to, except for just a. One is that this is a very different mass, so this is, you know, two orders of magnitude higher in the dark matter mass, and you're still excluding regions. These dotted lines are what you were asking about. So these regions right here are where you would see a phase shift in your interferometer without seeing decoherence.
Are they down to the same level? Because they merge,
So above the solid line, there's you get essentially complete decoherence. You get like order unity. You know, your off diagonal term is suppressed by at least an e-fold. There's no phase shift. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. So when you move through the dark matter is charged. So it's like moving through a charged medium. Isn't there some long range effective electric field or some sort of magnetic field that you could interact with, and those would introduce a phase?
Well, they wouldn't. They still don't have. Let's see. You're at.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw. You know. Honestly. Well, you're talking about right. So your density is this, and we're talking. So it, I guess for really that's a concern for really high masses that I hadn't even thought about. For these large masses, right? The density is you know.
It's low enough that you don't get any longer range effect.
That's right.
If you start making the mass lighter, then maybe.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about it. That's something we'll have to think about. Should I just skip over this next slide then? No, this is a KeV particle where it's embarrassing that I hadn't thought about that effect. So that's a KeV particle where, can we figure that out really quick? A million. I still don't think it's a problem, right? If you're at a KeV and a GeV per centimeter cubed, you're talking about a million per centimeter cubed, right? And that's the cubic root of that. So then you're talking about 10 to the minus 4 meters. So that's 100 microns, right?
Yeah, but the point is though that it still goes like the, it's an effect that goes like the coupling instead of the coupling squared. And you have to take it down to small coupling, right? The cross section that you're trying
that's
to
right.
see. Oh, it's one power of alpha m, right?
So alpha m, yeah, it's two powers of g. The
it's
couple,
two powers
yeah.
of g. This would go one power.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is what I'm saying. One goes like the one power, two power. So it's, these are small numbers. So.
Well, I'm glad we presented before we post on the archive. Then this is good. No, we'll talk about it more for sure.
Yeah, but if it's a massive, they still have a force. So it may be exponential kill, but if you're talking at micro separation between the dark matter, it's still irrelevant.
Just gotta estimate it. Yeah.
But
yep, for sure. What's the other thing you need to know about this?
Anyway.
Okay.
Continue.
I'm not going to be able to do it on figure that all out on my feet.
No, basically, because there may be an issue also with gradients and how is the, if it's a common phase on both arms, for example, it will still be an effect, right?
That's right.
So you still have to consider if there's a gradient and should this case, I don't know.
I think the gradient's, going to be pretty small.
Yeah,
we'll have to estimate it. So again, the dashed lines here are where the phase kicks in. So there's a little sliver region over a lot of these places where you would see a phase instead of decoherence. But again, the idea is just that over many ranges, it looks like there's good sensitivity. And then again, I'm just going to flash a plot. This is not important, but we're just taking a slice of a constant mediator mass, right? So it's a slice in into the board of what we were looking at before. Yeah, so 1 month of integrating for all these experiments. You only need stability. So in order to, most of the ways you're going to see this, especially the way you're going to see it in an experiment, if the guy's not dedicating the experiment to your analysis, which they won't be, is they're going to notice like things like 24-hour periods, something you can do in the data analysis very quickly afterwards. And so you really just need stability in these experiments, like phase stability over 24 hours, rather you don't need it over like a year or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, and that seems to be very possible. So one month of integrating. Yeah. So it's usually like order unity contrast. What they use is the visibility is what they call it. And so, you have something that looks like this, and so you have some like amplitude and then some like offset. And then the visibility is literally just maybe it's like offset minus amplitude over offset or something like that. Whatever, it goes from 0 to 1. And this is it's order unity kind of visibilities, because they're always going to kind of push it to where they're just barely able to be sure that there's interference. If they got perfect visibility, they would just move on to something harder. And so what you would be looking for if you're integrating statistically, right, would be that during the day it looks like this, and during the night it looks like that. Makes sense. That's right. Yeah, because this will be little dots. We talked about this. You were like it does not go with square root of time, and then we sat and talked, and you're like, I think you're right, Jess. Okay, then you left. yeah.
There seems to be always an underlying noise that comes from some source of coherence, right?
Right.
Because the fringe visibility is not, the contrast is not perfect.
Right.
The visibility is not perfect, it's not one.
Right.
So
which the way you can think about it, right, is you take some bin, okay, and you ask, how many events do I get in this bin, and how many events do I get in that bin?
Yeah.
And so I have some like expectation number during the day for on the crest, and then at night, and then I have another one for at nighttime, and then it's just a counting experiment, and then you're looking for, right, and so this is some number that's, you have 7 one day and 9 the next day or whatever, and then you're looking for the difference in the counting. I think that the counting experiment way is the way to think about it. You're estimating a number per day, and you have some sort of error bars just from root n uncertainty, and then as those get smaller is when you can separate. That's right. That's right. You say you sound, you're like, okay, I guess I'm kind of satisfied, but I don't believe you. I've seen this before. Counting experiments. Okay. Right, so I'm gonna do a slice at 20 EV mediator. So I'm gonna take a slice right here, just so you get what happens if you scale the dark matter, right? So we take that slice, the Yukawa constraint is just a straight line now. And this is the kind of plot you get. So you can kind of imagine you're at this wall set by the Yukawa constraint. We're kind of head on at the wall now. And these are how the different experiments bear out. Okay, and then this is just the last like two. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. So this is the satellite. Yes, that's right. So this is phase. This is the satellite. This is Otima, the good one. This is the Bateman proposal, and that's KDTL, the existing interferometer. So there's a few things that's so there's a lot that goes on in these plots, unfortunately, and I could talk about it all day. So you have a bunch of different regimes, and what we're mostly looking at is like right here. So you're just kind of seeing the tail end of this shoulder right here. This region in here is where you have intermediate coherence enhancement. So the typical, which is why it's so sharply falling. It has a very strong dependence on the mediator mass. You know, the typical momentum transfer. Once you get up into here, you're just actually like hard sphere scattering, and then when you're down here, you're all very very forward scattering. Most of the plot is very forward scattering. I confirm all this stuff by doing, you know, you take a bunch of limiting cases, but there's always like, this parameter is bigger than this parameter, then it goes to this limiting case. So that one's bigger than that one, so there's 30 of them. Okay. So I'm trying to think if there's anything really interesting here. Again, just as the dark matter mass, for no worries. As the dark matter mass gets larger, you're going to get less and less flux. And at some point, the mass is big enough that you're getting good resolution of it, but your flux is falling off. Okay, so right, last couple slides. This is just kind of the optimistic scenario. So you know how this kind of dark matter would thermalize in the Earth is totally who knows. You know, there's a bunch of differences, like kind of how much does it penetrate, how much does it reflect, what temperature does it actually thermalize at. For like an MeV dark matter, it comes in at like 2300 Kelvin, roughly, that kind of a range. And you actually, the best case scenario is where the Earth cools the dark matter, because then what you get is you get this greenhouse effect where you get the same flux you would as if you were a lighter dark matter. For light dark matter, so you have a high flux, but then it cools it down, and the cross sections for these Yukawa scattering events go up very strongly as the velocity gets small. So you cool it down, smaller velocities, bigger cross sections. So the kind of best case scenario is where it thermalizes very quickly, so that when it kind of comes out of the Earth, it's at 300, 400, 500 Kelvin, something like that. If it's more rarely interacting and is able to pass through, which I don't think is really feasible for any of these experiments, but wouldn't have to get that far. Then it's pretty hot anyways. But again, so just the kind of the most optimistic scenario where you have these greenhouse effects, you have a pretty serious enhancement. So all this pink region is all where the Otima experiment would have substantial new sensitivity. The macro satellite doesn't matter. It sits out at like L1 or L2, you know, one of the Lagrange points. So it doesn't care about what's happening with the Earth. Because of this greenhouse effect, the Bateman experiment would then become sensitive. Okay, so last two slides. What are the take-home messages? Just going all the way back to where we started. It's been a long talk. So colder targets, classical targets, are more sensitive to small kicks. large superposition. So after you cool down to what's essentially, you know, negative temperature, they have a quantum enhanced sensitivity. And the sense in which they're more sensitive to small momentum kicks is precise in the sense of an SQL, just like for, you know, LIGO using squeeze light and these kind of things. Interferometers are especially sensitive because of just the scale of these things at this point in their abilities. They're especially sensitive to medium range forces. And so they're going to be most competitive when the size of the object is in this 10 to 50 nanometer range, and therefore when the force is in this range. You know, there's a million different ways you can imagine the dark sector, and so you could kind of enhance or suppress it, but kind of try to stick with more or less the most simple scenario you can imagine in this talk. Finally, this is a little bit to your question. So why do people build these superpositions in the first place? They're not just so Jess has papers to write. So they do it to push the limits of quantum mechanics. I definitely don't buy that any of these terrible collapse models that people put in. But there's something about the fact that quantum mechanics predicts this huge, huge Hilbert space, of which almost none of it we're able to access, right? And it's really this kind of amazing prediction that there's all these states that don't have any kind of a classical analog. And so really just seeing if they're there, I think is very worthwhile anyways. So that's one of the reasons that people do this. One way you can kind of phrase that, you know, Scott Aronson has this great phrase, the shore separator, which is, you know, what if you don't think you can do quantum computation, you know, what's the difference between the states we're sure we can produce in the laboratory and the ones that you need for Shor's algorithm? And what, you know, people have, if they don't think quantum mechanics is quite right or if there's something that's going to prevent quantum computation, you look for some sort of difference in there. And one of the things is just how big can you get in terms of your big superpositions? Just improves techniques for suppressing decoherence, quantum control, being able to manipulate large chunks of matter in a quantum coherent way. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you have the sensitivity to classical forces, so not the kind of quantum particles and entangling interactions I've been talking about, but just classical kind of short and medium range forces. And so this talk is just to give another reason to build these superpositions, and it's because they're sensitive to tiny momentum transfers and diffusive forces. How could that actually bear out rather than just putting another line on your grant proposal? It in particular gives new motivation for large separation nanomechanical resonators. So with these devices that I mentioned briefly where they kind of wiggle up and down very softly, the problem is that they're not very sensitive because they don't get very much coherence. They don't wiggle very much, and it's because they're clamped to something. They're physically supported. And if you try to wiggle them too much, they just decohere too fast. And so there are aggressive plans to declamp them, to basically levitate them. So levitating mirrors purely based off of radiation pressure and other really crazy ideas like this. And I think that this kind of sensitivity is a reason to move more in that direction, towards things that are declamped, levitated, and which allows you to get very large coherence over very large distances, because you no longer get decoherence from that key source. Thank you very much for the attention and the questions. Like I said, there's nothing on the archive right now. But if you're like, I care just enough about this to put something in my phone, but not enough to check the archive in a month, then you can email me and I'll send you it when it's there. Any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned at one point these non-classical states like be thought of as a negative temperature.
Yeah, just in the sense that, it's just very vague intuition. Just in the sense that positive temperature states are these noisy things where you have less sensitivity to jostling. Right? If you're already very noisy because you're hot, you don't see anomalous jostling. You can't tell. Your sensitivity gets higher and higher and higher as you cool down. And then you hit T equals zero, and you can't go beyond that with a classical state. So if you were saying, you know, what is the effective temperature in terms of sensitivity to new particles, new sources of diffusion, that's the sense in which it's a negative temperature, but not in the thermodynamic sense.
And another question, I didn't follow why there's a direction sensitivity. So, you know,
Yeah, so it comes just from, and I didn't talk about this at all. It comes just from, you've got your dark particle coming in, and you got the two out states, and you're trying, so this is the two possible positions of the object, and your ability to decohere is set by the overlap of these two out states. And literally just rotating them around, just by like the phase shift between them, will change how well you can distinguish them. It's only an order unity change, but it's enough such that if you rotate the interferometer, the interference pattern will pulse.
But the wavelength is less than the distance between them, so why does it matter how they're oriented?
So if
carry information
away. Good. So insofar as the wavelength is much less, then this effect goes away. It's only when it's comparable or longer. So how do you get decoherence when it's longer? This is another thing I didn't have time to talk about. How do you get decoherence when it's longer? You have many of these scattering events. And so if you have enough such that the combined influence, the combined momentum transfer is comparable to it, that's when you'll get the orientation sensitivity, right? The question is dark out left versus dark out right. And if the superposition lasts long enough that you have multiple scattering events, this, right, they're all independent, and so they just become some product over these guys, right? The ith dark matter particle. And so even if there's, for a single one of these, for one dark matter particle, there's a high overlap between the out states such that that single particle can't resolve the superposition. If you multiply enough of them together, it gets small, and it's, you know, yeah. Yeah, it was, so there's several things that go on, but the biggest one is just that, So first is that there's some wind, and you're rotating with respect to the wind, right? So you're getting this orientation effect depending on where you are in the parameter space. In addition, the Earth is like this big wind screen, right? So it if you just left your experiment run overnight, it kind of blocks the bulk component of the wind part of the time, and then exposes you to the rest of the time. And so you just have a higher flux and more of the kind of the large momentum tail. Depending on where the Earth is situated. That's right. I mean, it's the whole solar system that goes right. Yeah, but exactly. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate it. So it's hard to really indicate that a bowling ball is a person, you know. But how, what did the dark matter look like? It's just, yeah, exactly.